This is part three.
So Dan, we talked about your role at the Institute of Industrial Relations early on, and really just, you know, continuously since you've been here. And I also, I'm remembering that we were just when we had to break off a couple weeks ago, we were talking about, or beginning to talk about, the founding of the School of Public Policy, or Public Affairs, or, you know, whatever you're calling it, Luskin, whatever you're calling it currently, which is, I believe, back about 94, 95?
Yeah, in that period. My recollection is that the university had commissioned a study originally about just creating some kind of ORU type institute, some kind of multidisciplinary thing to worry about public policy in California, really. And that was on the heels of the LA riots. So there had been interest in, you know, something ought to be done, and here we are, the local.
This is the Rodney King.
Right. Yeah. Not the Watts riots, but the. Right. So that's early 1992 is the LA riots, and there's a concern about things are going on in this area that need addressing, and so this idea of having a sort of an institute then evolved into a much more elaborate scheme of having a school with departments and students and programs and so on, as well as research type activities. And Archie Kleingartner, who was one of my colleagues at Anderson, but had a lot of administrative connections,
he was chair of the Senate, just around that.
Well, he had been chair of the Senate. I mean, he did lots of things. He was effectively the kind of, I don't know exactly what the title was, but he was vice president up in, I guess at that point it was Berkeley rather than Oakland, but at the UC headquarters academic personnel, and so on. And then he came back, and he was, for a while, he was my associate director at the Institute of Industrial Relations. About just a colleague, longtime colleague at Anderson, so he got involved in chairing this committee that was ultimately formed to come up with a design for the school, which also, I mean, a whole lot of things came together. So there were these public policy concerns about things that had gone on in the local area, plus the fact that we were then in one of our periodic budget crises.
Right.
And the school, the university as a whole, was looking to save money. And there was notions of sort of consolidating things. The original plan sort of evolved into taking the freestanding School of Social Work and turning it into a department of some school, taking architecture and urban planning, which had been a unified school, taking architecture out of that and putting it in the same department as social welfare, and then taking the School of Public Policy and also turning it from a school into a department. So you would have, in effect, gotten rid of a whole bunch of deans and the whole entourages that go with them by turning them into departments within a school with just one dean. And that's what, you know, that's where the money saving was.
And there was also some discussion of actually folding in the School of Public Health.
Right, public, that's what I'm saying.
Oh,
School of Public Health.
Right, public health, yeah.
Right, so public health,
urban planning, social welfare, and they would all somehow, the basic idea of public policy wasn't so controversial in itself, but
no. And then there would be a new department created within that called the, you know, which would be what is now the Department of Public Policy. So the names of all of this, of course, kept changing as things evolved, but that was the grand plan. Now the School of Public Health did not want to be dismembered. Partly they argued that in order to be accredited by whatever accredits schools of public health, they couldn't be a department. The departments didn't meet some criterion, but a school did. But I mean, that by itself didn't work because, you know, clever people came up with a way of sort of having a school within a school for purposes of accreditation, but really having just a department. So then they just sort of plain old revolted and said, we're not going to go. Never mind the legalities. We're just not going to go. And the upshot was that they didn't go. But the other piece that fell out of that was that put them in bad graces with the chancellor's office because it cut the money-saving component of all of this and went against the grand plan. And as a result, money moved in some complicated way from money that would have been in public health to money that helped create the new Department of Public Policy. So the Department of Public Policy benefited from this revolt in public health. Now, whether that carried over into, you know, in the long run, things get forgotten, and you know, whether there are fewer FTE in public health today and more FTE in public policy than there would have been under some other circumstances is hard to say. But at the immediate point, yes, that's what essentially happened.
Now, were you in the middle of the politics, or did you try?
Well, I wasn't in the middle of politics, but I was on the committee that was planning the school, and that committee had representation in the form of Rick Brown, now deceased, yes. but from the School of Public Health. So he conveyed the resistance. But he wasn't doing it on his own. I mean, this was resistance that was coming from the larger faculty.
Right.
And so as the whole plan evolved, School of Public Health was dropped out of the plan, so the new school became social welfare, which I'm not aware that there was great resistance there. I don't know why they wouldn't have resisted, you know, going from being a school to being just a department within a school, but they certainly didn't put up the kind of resistance that showed up from public health.
That's true. Yeah. Without getting into this, my side of this too much, let's say they were blindsided, and I think they were stunned long enough.
Whatever.
Right.
All right. So then, of course, and then public policy starts out with a department that has no faculty. So then how does a department with no faculty go about hiring people to be faculty? Well, all the original people who were sort of forming this department had zero time appointments. So it wasn't clear how do you have a vote, you know, how do you make offers, how do you do things, but the kind of initial dean of the, later called the founding dean of the school, was Archie Kleingartner.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to have a school of public policy with a department of public policy. Again, the titles were all mixed up in this. And so we somehow all this got finessed and we began creating a department and having votes and doing things. And, of course, ultimately, any appointment has to get approved all the way up through the chancellor's office.
New appointments.
And Chuck Young was in favor of having all of this happen. And, of course, he became a member in retirement, ultimately, to the Department of Public Policy. But it was his, you know, this was part of his thing, and so that helped the process.
Now, you took
process.
Quite a leadership role in this.
Well,
right?
Yes, the first department chair was... the first department chair was Joel Aberbach.
Oh, yes.
From Poli Sci. He did it for a year, and then I was the second chair. But I think all of this business about actually hiring people, taking votes, and so on, came up during that period. And so I actually would meet with Archie once a week. We both at that time, he lived just outside of Santa Monica, very close to where I live, and there was this little cheesy restaurant that we would meet in once a week for breakfast on Saturday mornings, and we would sort of plot out things to
so
get.
This was all designed at the Brentwood Mart or something.
Right. Across the street from the Brentwood Mart, yes.
It's not so cheesy these days.
Well, at that time it was the Kate and Nate or
yes,
that. I think that's where we met. We actually met frequently enough that they had this thing where you, if you had, you know, 10 breakfasts, you got the 11th one free, you know. So we had a few freebies on that. But anyway, that's how the department formed and the school formed. Now, there also there were politics within the larger academic senate, which ultimately had to approve. You're going to create a school, you're creating departments, you're doing all these things. All that had to get voted on. And there was a concern, particularly from the college, and particularly because some of the joint appointments were going to come from the college.
The people who were already here.
Right, and there were people who were here who would be doing, who, let's say, would have been in poli-sci or sociology or whatever it would be, who would then be doing some teaching in the Department of Public Policy.
Their FTE would be partially...
Well, even if their FTE, the question is, most probably wouldn't be, but they would be paid to do a course. And then the question, you know, at what rate would they be paid? You know, would the department be fully reimbursed?
Is it the departments would have to,
right,
would
you
have
know,
to basically give up part of their service?
Right, they would then, you know, and then they'd have to go hire somebody else or lecturers or visitors or whatever. And so all kinds of behind-the-scenes deal-making occurred about what the reimbursement rate would be sufficient to qualm... To quiet these qualms.
This is the meat and potatoes, and right. the underbelly of right. academic
right.
administration.
Well, no different than right. you know lots of other political organizations.
Now, did you actually transfer part of your FTE?
Yes, I moved 50% of my FTE from Anderson. I think Archie Kleingartner did the same thing. And there were others who actually moved FTE. Some moved they had zero time sort of courtesy appointments originally, but some of them had, you know, decided they would have zero time, but I don't know, whatever you call it, but the voting right version of zero time, you know, and so they had more... you know, political weight within the department in terms of votes and that sort of thing. So there was a mix, but then we began hiring, you know, 100% time people, and so that's kind of how the department evolved. But we had to have the idea was that there would be a standalone MPP program, and that the responsibility from that, Archie's original idea is he wanted all three departments to somehow participate in that, and so it would have been a kind of a cross-department thing, but it didn't evolve that way, and so the MPP essentially became the degree for the Department of Public Policy, and although in the MPP program maybe there were you know, electives that you could take in urban planning or social welfare, or that sort of thing. But that was the extent of it. Archie also, I think he had a vision, again, of more interaction between the three departments.
That did not work out so well?
And, well, that was his vision, but he didn't remain dean. And when Barbara Nelson came in as dean, there was, I mean, she viewed the three departments as being three separate entities in the same way that the dean of the college would say, you know, sociology is separate from economics or, you know, any of the other departments within the college. And while, yes, there might be a Professor X or Y who would have some joint appointment or whatever, but really the departments have their own programs and responsibilities and so on. So she was more, if you like, compartmentalized in her view of the three departments than he wanted it to be, although whether his desire for it to be that way would have worked out, you know, that's, you know, also ultimately you have to have willing participants.
As you were heavily involved in these years, did you find that barriers between the departments broke down a little bit over time, or did they?
I think they are three separate departments with some crosses in the same way, again, a joint department, joint appointments and so on might
sociology
occur.
And political science.
Right. Or, and you know, the students in the MPP program can take courses in, say, urban planning or social welfare as part of their programs, but the core of their program is pretty much sort of within the department. You know, in the same way that somebody, you know, who is in the Department of Economics but as a student might take a course in some other department.
Right. And all three of the departments have, they have clearly identifiable professional master's degrees that,
right,
that are the core,
right,
of those fields. In,
yeah, essentially.
So that kind of defined them.
You know, urban planning actually had an M.A., and there was talk, and I'm not really sure how that, there are certain advantages for having a professional degree in the sense that they now get this extra tuition,
right,
sort of thing, and I'm not sure how that ultimately worked out, but at the time, they had what you might call a de facto professional degree, you know. They also had a PhD program, as does social welfare. The Department of Public Policy does not have a...
Is that still true?
That's still true. There's no...
So those small doctoral programs did stay in those two departments,
right,
basically.
Right, right. And the... I don't think there was ever, you know, substantial, at least while I was sort of active in the department, substantial appetite for let's go create a doctoral program, because it was enough to just get up and running with you know, getting a core faculty together and staffing the MPP requirements, plus there's some responsibilities for, there's an undergraduate minor in public
plan.
Yeah, well, public, well, there is one, but there is a public policy minor, to which different departments contribute.
Right.
So that's a little bit more in the Kleingartner mode.
And that was established fairly early, but,
right,
but it always continued to be a small...
Well, it's not so small.
Not,
I think it's not so small now. But you know, of course, initially, when you create anything, it starts out relatively small. There, you know, there's been talk over the years of maybe it should become, you know, a regular minor, a major, in the same way that you could major in lots of other things, but that hasn't happened either, and that requires a whole ramp up of things that you would have to do just to support a major as opposed to a minor in
right.
terms of, you know, academic advising and lots of the logistical support.
In terms of your personal research interests and the kind of service work that you gradually found yourself doing, I don't think you designed yourself. I think you just sort of
fell into it.
One thing happened. Put together one thing after another. So yes, I do this and I do that too, and all that sort of connected. And I edit that, and and I do that too. So all of these interests, which had really sort of emerged from your background in economics and in management, and even in management, you always had a kind of a unique role. You weren't an accounting professor, to put it mildly.
Right.
So did you feel that you were able to, integrate these interests that you had, your particular intellectual and public service interests? Did they articulate with the School of Public Policy or with the department?
One thing that I did was some of the courses that I taught in Anderson, we in effect cross-listed them, because I taught a labor markets course, which is, we had a sort of a, within the MPP, people, there were a certain number of people that had those sorts of interests, so they could come over. So I'm using the word cross-listing. What we actually did was create, there was a separate course, but the two courses met at the same time and place with the same instructor, had the same exams and all that sort of thing.
Whoever is listening to this recording 50 years in the future, they don't want to know about the mysteries of various ways of cross-listing courses.
But what was done, and I had on the other hand, I had an international course that I taught at Anderson, which we didn't cross-list, but nonetheless, if anybody in the MPP program wanted to come and do that, and there were a certain number of students that did have international interests, so they would come and do it. So de facto, there was a kind of a thing that occurred sort of through a personality, through me, that sort of permitted this sort of cross-department.
And did you have I remember part of the discussion was how is this program in this school, how is it going to stand out, or how is it going to even compare with other prominent programs? There's the Kennedy School programs.
Right.
Berkeley is probably the one that we think of most here on the West Coast. There are others, of course. Did you have a model, or the people you were working with?
Well, there were, in designing the MPP degree, there were various faculty members involved who went and visited other schools and so on. The interesting thing, and this has to do, this shows the power of the UCLA brand. There are these rankings of departments that appear. So I remember there was some ranking when the school was created and the department was created, which ranked us in the top 20 or something before we had done anything,
Well, there is that advantage, isn't there?
So that was, of course, that was a help. The school, people applied for the degree when it was announced. It wasn't like there was a great shortage of applicants or anything. So, not surprisingly, initially a lot of the people were more local types, but then that
But you
that
hit the ground running,
right.
And you were, from the very get-go, you were more than just a regional university public policy program.
I'm going to shut off my phone so it won't bother us.
So how long were you involved in terms of the, you know, well, leadership forever, but how long were you involved in actually the sort of the building up of the department? You became the chair of the department.
Right. So that I think that went on for at least 2 years. The other piece of my activity was we had created, this is, you know, before the school came into existence, but because I was connected with the forecast and there was pressure to have the forecast have more of a student activity, because the only activity it actually had was hiring research assistants and that type. So we created an undergraduate course that was very much linked to the California side of the forecast, and originally was done as a special elective through the economics department. I think we mentioned that in the last go-round on this, on the recordings. But so that course eventually evolved into what is now Public Policy 10B. So it became part of this undergraduate minor in public policy. And that's where it is today. And then Michael Dukakis joined me as co-instructor on that about, I'm going to say, maybe 96, something around that period. So we've been doing it for all that time, 20 years now, something like that. And that course has pretty much stayed, the format of it has pretty much stayed the same as it, you know, as it originally was. Now it's kind of heavily oversubscribed, so there we get big waiting lists and so on for people. But the course itself pretty much has continued.
Mm-hmm. And is a course where there's always like a scramble for more resources, more teaching assistants?
I mean, we do have a teaching, we have one teaching assistant. That,
oh, really? Yeah. Oh, so you don't have a lot of support?
No, in fact, the teaching, one of the things that's unique about the course is the teaching assistant in the course does the logistical stuff. We bring in a lot of guest speakers, and their parking has to be arranged, and student records have to be kept. We require attendance because we're bringing in these guest speakers, you know, and they come and then they're gone. You can't just read that chapter in the textbook and you know, make up that thing. So we take attendance at the beginning of the period and at the end of the period. So we make a big fuss about that. But in any event, so we need a TA to do those kinds of things, and the TA also acts as a kind of a writing counselor, because we've been finding over the years that anywhere from 25, 30 something percent have issues about writing and need assistance. So the TA handles that. But all the papers, you know, things that they turn in are read by the instructors. And all the grading is done by the instructor, so we do not delegate anything that has to do with evaluation. So the students get a lot more attention from their instructors than maybe they even want. But they get it, but it's for that reason. Well, that's the reason the course is capped at 60. Is that, you know, there's, you know, reading 60. Papers and doing all that stuff. Yeah, that does a lot and has to be done within a fairly tight time frame. They get comments from the instructors and all kinds of things that you know, as part of that process. So they, for example, they have to hand in first an outline of their report, and then they hand in a draft. So we read the drafts, and then they hand in the final version. And at each step, they get emailed comments and so on. So there's a fairly intensive piece of that. Now, in terms of the research, so one thing that happened originally, I mean, there are no textbooks in California policy per se, but USC, when I first started, they had somebody up there who was actually stationed up in Sacramento, and would put together a book with chapters on sort of current issues in California. So we were using that as a textbook for the first few years, and then all of a sudden it didn't come out. And it turned into a guy retired, and there was no money to continue it, and so on. So I started doing a sort of a version of that, getting sort of just, you know, begging people to write me chapters.
Right.
And so that we put it out and called it California Policy Options, and that's been coming out every year, and it becomes a kind of a de facto textbook for the students. And in fact, we now use some of the on a couple of occasions, some of the undergraduate papers that they do for the course have been turned into chapters if they're, you know, meet the need and the quality and so on. Plus, the MPP students do kind of team reports for their as part of the degree requirement, and a lot of them, in effect, end up working in the LA area. So they do California-related things, and to the extent that those are useful, I sometimes can recruit them to do a little rewriting of their reports they do for that into sort of chapter.
Now, was it around this period when you found yourself focusing more and more on California?
Yeah, well, that,
and, you know,
that
municipal issues? And
that began to happen just kind of as a byproduct of the course.
So teaching and research actually had something
right.
to do with it.
Well, and then, you know, the early days of the Gray-Davis budget crisis, I had trouble getting people to write chapters on the budget. You know, people did seem to be doing work on other things, but I think the problem was that when I was an undergraduate, there was this field called public finance. And as an undergraduate, I took a course with, you know, one of the Columbia University experts in this who had a textbook. And, you know, we learned about sales taxes and, you know, things of that type.
Nitty-gritty
kind of stuff. And that, you know, the field of economics now calls this public economics as opposed to public finance. So this, yeah, this budget and all that stuff, you know, is too
low status.
To be done. Now, you can find some of that. I found that there is a professional group, and the people who belong to the professional group are people who actually still work in this field. You know, they are at CSU campuses and so on. But, you know, the big research universities, you don't find that. So I was kind of looking around, you know, and what particularly caught my attention was, well, I said, well, let me look at, you know, see what's going on. I know there's this sort of funny stuff going on, and the economy then was just turning down, and I figured that can't be good. And yet there were these sort of assurances coming out of Gray Davis as a chief budgeteer, how everything is fine, and remember we had an electricity crisis. Now, don't worry, we're going to pay for that out of the surplus. And so I looked at the official documents, and I noticed that as I read them, the state was spending more than it was taking in. And I had trouble conceiving of that as a surplus. But, you know, I was, you know, so what did I know, you know? All I had was this undergraduate course, you know, years before. So I went to Verna Hirsch, who was a senior professor in the economics department. I showed him this, you know, and so, among other things, you know, the two of us began writing chapters, and one of the early things that we did was we wrote an op-ed to the LA Times saying, you know, essentially Gray Davis and company are telling you that they're going to be paying for this crisis in electricity that we have out of the surplus, and yet we read their official documents and there's a deficit. and, you know, it's a very angry letter that essentially accused us of lying came out of from the budget director as a reaction to this. And of course, a year later, he discovered that he wanted to spend more time with his family and was gone. And then it wasn't too much longer that the electorate decided that Gray Davis could also be gone
earlier than scheduled.
Right, earlier than scheduled. You know, so. That's one of our fond memories, that maybe if somebody had paid a little more attention to this op-ed, you know, things might have evolved differently, but they did. But in any case, so then I began writing, co-writing with Werner Hirsch on the state budget. Of course, he passed on eventually, and so then I've continued doing an annual chapter for this volume on the state budget.
And it was, it wasn't exactly a new field, but it was a field that you and Herzog sort of, I mean, I remember reading a little bit about this at the time. From my perspective, you sort of raise it up a little bit. I mean, the Cal State has a lot of wonderful folks, as you discovered more and more. You know, the California Studies people, probably you were interacting with them. But there are real limits on what they can do, kind of, like, you know, how big their voices can be, given all that teaching they have to do, basically. And your background, your research background, it just sort of clicked. And again, this wasn't a plan. This was
right. Just something I got interested in. And I mean, I think the, you know, that this little anecdote about the budget director is saying there's a surplus. When you sort of in common English terms, spending more than taking in doesn't sound like a surplus. But what I discovered was that in the nitty-gritty world of state and local budgets, not just in California, but more generally, this kind of confusion about what's a surplus and what's a deficit and so on is sort of just built into the system. And you know, built in to the point where I think, you know, if you are a term limited member of the state legislature and somebody tells you that you have a surplus when you actually have a deficit, you probably don't have anybody who's going to contradict that. And it's partly because the legislative analyst also does, you know, kind of goes with the flow, and this is the way state and local budgeteers kind of talk. There are no kind of clear-cut definitions of these terms, and as a result, essentially what this fellow, the official budgeteer who called us liars, meant was there was still money left in the till. You know, it's as if, you know, let's say, if you have your checking account, and every year there's less and less in it, I guess you could say you have a surplus until the last penny disappears. At that point, you certainly have a problem at that point. But you don't, if you keep saying you have a surplus until the last penny disappears, you get no warning of the fact that you can't keep going on
because
that's sort of built into the way to the way in which state and local budgets are kept, and the fact that there is no standardized budget methodology. Mm-hmm. And so the problem, and then when I, you know, I became a member of this professional group and went to some of their meetings and so on, and you know, people there tended to, you know, not question these sorts of things. At the first meeting I attended, so I gave a talk about the California budget, and there were big headlines about how California had, at that time, I don't know, the deficit as it was being reported was $20 billion, and the budget was, let's say, $80 billion in terms of expenditures. So I said to them, now, could it really be the case that you know, if you had an $80 billion budget. You would have a $20 billion that really, you know, that those, or that anybody would even, if that were to occur, that you wouldn't just throw up your hands and go home, right? I mean, because also the version of what a deficit is, when they finally acknowledge having one, is a kind of a compendium of last year's deficit and the one we project next year if we don't do anything, plus, you know, plus that and the other thing. There, again, there's no standard definition, and sometimes it pays for political types who want to say, sometimes as a political, you want to say that this is terrible and horrendous and so on, so you better just adopt my solution, you see. And so the headline numbers, you know, have very little to do with, you know, kind of any analytical approach to budget making.
So they can be kind of off in either direction.
Right. It can be off, and it can be off in the direction that you, as the budget director, would like it to be.
You know, one thing, as somebody who just tries to pay attention to this, I mean, I've known for a long time that there's a lot more than the general fund, but I've never figured out all those other funds that are around. And so you actually, you tried to work out all these reserve funds and the fund for this and the fund for that.
There is, you know, and as you get into, you know, the most recent kind of budgeting we're doing, where Jerry Brown got the voters to create a rainy day fund. So we have a kind of a regular reserve, and then we've got a regular a rainy day fund reserve, which actually is kind of compartmentalized, all of which makes for even more of a miasma around the budget, which in certain respects, see, if you're a politician, having a miasma around the budget can be helpful, right?
And it's in this context that you found yourself more and more interested in things like pension plans, municipal pension plans as well, I would imagine.
Right. Well, that also...
The fact that you're in one yourself.
Well, that too, but actually that you know, really goes more back to my labor interests.
Yes.
Because this whole question of the changing retirement scene in the private sector, now an issue in the public sector, but long before that, it was an issue in the private sector, because there began to be this shift from defined benefit to defined contribution and all of that. So that was a big trend in people who were, it was certainly an interest for people in labor economics.
So you've got the background in labor economics and a particular set of interests and perspectives on that. And then really, as you narrated, kind of separately, the municipal finance, or the public finance, rather, right, that's kind of separate. But these two things overlap most clearly when it comes to the whole question of, well, I'm saying pension plans, but I mean more than that, the whole question of the compensation, right, and the possibility of compensation.
Right, and remember that, you know, going back, and again, Werner Hirsch played a role in this, he got me interested in being on the faculty welfare committees, so the retirement program, both the health part and the pension income piece of it, were, you know, subjects of interest all during that period. So from the 80s, 90s, I'm still on this TFIR, task force on investment and retirement,
yes,
which is a subcommittee of the system-wide welfare committee. So I've been...
Permanent, temporary.
Right, I seem to have tenure.
Permanent. The membership of the other committee comes and goes, but that committee...
Right.
Yeah,
because
I was on that.
Right.
But that subcommittee goes on forever.
Right. And it, you know, so it has that element to it. And I think I mentioned also this, that I became involved through a happenstance in the health part of the pay system of the MTA, as it relates one of the union groups there. So I'm still chairman of this labor management committee.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that also proves to be very educational to see how, retirement, because there is there are a lot of retirees in the health part of their program, plus all the active people in it, and just how these health benefits get negotiated with Kaiser and the big carriers in this area.
Right. And you were mentioning the secular trend, if we can call it, of the shift, really primarily, at least initially, in the private sector, but also increasingly touching the public sector, of the shift from defined benefit to a defined contribution, and also something we're still very much living through right now, a kind of a sustained and sometimes even shrill criticism of the inevitable financial danger, the risk of defined benefit plans of any sort, and the complications of discount rates, all that sort of thing. But my point is that it seems to me that you're at odds with a lot of other economists. I mean, I'm just thinking of the economists at Stanford, who have kind of the Hoover Institute types,
right,
who've worked a great deal on this, both with respect to the economics, but also very, very much as a sort of a public policy, one might even say political. Do you ever find yourself locking horns with these folks, or do you?
Well, nowadays, what my involvement is only with TFER and writing the blog for the Faculty Association. So, I think in the economics profession is not quite so unified as you might think. There are different views.
Some
about
of the more
it.
Vocal aspects.
Right.
Stanford, I mentioned the Hoover Institute,
right,
because it's not just doesn't represent all economists, but it is a very, very vocal think tank. Who want,
right,
want to
I mean, there, I mean, I think there's a lot of there are different ways of looking at something like a defined benefit pension. There's this whole field that developed in economics of this sort of cross between psychology and economics, where you don't necessarily assume the sort of the traditional rational rational actor who maximizes welfare and all of this sort of thing, and that you find that there are all these sort of oddities and contradictions in human behavior, which probably are of no surprise to people in psychology or any other field in economics, but were shocking to economics. And so from that perspective, to say, for example, that people aren't very good at dealing with risk and dealing with long-term planning for their retirement on their own. This is not something new and shocking to people in psychology. Maybe there's been more work on, trying to measure these things and write them up in professional journals and so on. But that idea has been around, and really is what explains why do we have defined, who would have thought them up to begin with, right? If everybody could take care of these things on their own, well, there wouldn't be nobody would have created something that for which there was absolutely no need. And so I think there is that side of it. But then there's also the funding side, and the fact that, you are shifting risk from the employee to the employer, and how does the employer respond in terms of producing a plan that can deal with economic shocks and so on, and particularly in the public sector where there is a strong element of political decision-making that goes on, how does the public sector deal with the fact that it is taking on a risk that essentially it can, in the expression that I guess Schwarzenegger kept using, kicking the can down the road. If you have a defined benefit plan, you can go a long time before you actually run out of money. And that long time goes way beyond your electoral horizon. So there's all of that, which is mixed up in this, and that's part of the story. But I did it sort of independently of all of this. I got interested in some of this history, and ultimately wrote a book that started out with something that I knew very early when I first came out here. I read a book about sort of California and, you know, just its history and so on, and I became aware, but never really did anything with it, that there had been in the 1930s something called the Ham and Eggs Movement. And the Ham and Eggs Movement was a scheme that appeared on the state ballot and came close to passing that would have had the state create a pension plan that would have been $30 a week, $30 every Thursday is how it became known. The state would create this plan, and it would essentially create a kind of a state currency to fund it. So it wouldn't cost anything because you just create this money. And the quid pro quo is, remember, this is the Great Depression era, is that the folks over 50 who are going to be the beneficiaries of this promise not to work. So they just live off this $30 every Thursday, which in Depression era pricing, you know, was pretty good money.
It all sounds very French these days.
Right? Well, and this was, you know, a really serious thing that went on in kind of royal state. So I knew that in the back of my mind that there was such a thing. But then I ultimately wrote a book about it because it turned out, as you sort of got into it, that this was a sort of an outgrowth of an earlier California movement that went national called the Townsend Plan. The Townsend Plan would have had everybody over 60 who promised not to work. You had to also promise to spend all the money because that would stimulate the economy. See? The Townsend Plan would have everybody who was sick get $200 a month, which, you know, again, at the bottom of the Depression, that was a hell of a lot of money. So a couple, if you were, you know, a couple 60, you would get $400 a month. I mean, and so I started looking into that. Now, that was a national plan. That would have been financed by a kind of a tax scheme. And that roiled national politics. So in fact, at the time, the Roosevelt administration is trying to create Social Security, and they have, you know, a committee putting together things. And so Social Security was a very radical idea at the time, particularly in the U.S. context. But compared to the Townsend Plan, it was just this measly, you know, few nickels compared to what you what you would be getting from the Townsend scheme. So the, you know, the elderly population, they didn't want Social Security. I mean, they wanted, and there were Townsend senators and Townsend congresspeople elected, and a whole lot of, you know, so politics were, you know, but because of that, so you're a member of Congress who's not part of this, you don't want to vote twice against your elderly constituents. You know, so you're going to vote against Townsend when that comes up. But then Social Security becomes the moderate alternative. You know, so I mean, there is some evidence that this, you know, in a way, this kind of agitation led to, you know, the enactment of Social Security, which otherwise was a controversial scheme.
Which was that 37?
Well, 35 is when the bill came through. The Townsend plan was originally articulated. It started out in the in a Long Beach newspaper and grew into this national movement, and the, you know, all kinds of offshoots of this, and it's sort of the, so that the ham and eggs was the state version of Townsend, but without the nasty tax, because you just kind of create the money, and that, you know, solves the unpleasant side
of the tax.
Of the tax, and then of course they, there's a whole story of this which I tell every year to the class, where they were involved with, there was, the whole scheme was run by total con artists who were really in it just to keep raising money. And they got involved, the ham and eggs people, and they, I mean, the Townsend scheme was doing pretty well, but this thing was a local version of that, and they got involved with all kinds of things that got into municipal corruption, the recall of the mayor, a car bombing. I mean, this is, this is, you know, the wildest kind of thing that you can imagine, and, you know, continued roiling state politics until, by the 1950s, you know, the kind of this, California was an elder, was a Florida, in the 30s.
Right.
But, it, you know, the politics shifted as the demographics shifted. So by the, there were still remnants of it even into the 60s.
Right.
But,
all those oranges and those little towns east of town.
Yeah, there were, you know, elderly people still waiting for this thing to happen. But it began to fade afterwards. They did actually succeed in getting something on the ballot that passed at one point. It lasted for a year and then was undone by another ballot initiative.
That's fascinating. Actually, I did not know that.
Yeah. So I wrote a book about this.
It's got some good economic ideas in it, stimulating demand.
Well,
and,
this is,
you know, money from the helicopter. And all right. That sort of thing.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I also, you know, I mentioned in our earlier interview that I fell into becoming president of what was then called the North American Economics and Finance Association. You know, where, although that's really not my thing, and I had to give a presidential address. So, you know, I knew something from my international course about, you know, the free silver movement, which was a reaction against the gold standard and so on. So I figured, and I knew something about the Bretton Woods and all of this stuff. So I wrote my presidential address was this tracing of all this sort of agitation around gold from the free silver days, William Jennings Bryan and all of that, through, then there was an iteration under Roosevelt administration. He was fiddling around with gold and so on, that was kind of a reflection in part of some of that, and part of other ideas that were interesting enough coming out of two agricultural economists at Cornell. Got the ear of the king for a while. The Bretton Woods system and how that evolved. And then finally Nixon, you know, kind of undoing the whole thing. And so that was my presidential address, which appeared in there. Journal, but I went off to the Roosevelt Library and looked up stuff and got a lot of material to pull that together.
Ham and eggs, interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we circled around and gone off on a few little tangents here, but I guess it's because I really wanted to kind of, you know, not that the politics of public policy are not interesting, but sort of, you know, bring it back to the, you know, to the research, to the stuff, to the work that you've done, and they're really, from my perspective, they're a very unique way in which you sort of weave together, I guess activism is not quite the word, I guess involvement, would that be
That's
more
fair.
Accurate than activism?
Because right.
you're not out there waving things so much. But involvement, sometimes accidental involvement, and that either that, you know, based to some extent on expertise you have, and that leads to an interest, and that leads to another expertise in the combining right. of these things, and these things go on and on. I'm jumping a lot right now. We can come back to some more of this if you'd like. But
well, I guess the final sort of piece
okay.
of my research side
yeah.
Came about through, you know, I think I mentioned when I was sort of very early on as an assistant professor, I did some work with Murray Schwartz on contingent pay for lawyers
right.
and
yeah.
so on.
Right.
So that's a compensation plan, if you like. It's
yeah.
it's meant to be an incentive plan. So I kind of retained that interest, but I didn't do much with it for a while. Then there was kind of in the late 70s, early 80s, there was all this interest in stagflation, which kind of dovetailed with the work I had done about so-called incomes policy and wage price controls and all of that, and some issues about whether I got interested in whether, you know, changing the compensation system in some way or other might sort of facilitate these kind of very, what seemed to be very painful adjustments of trying to get off a relatively high inflation economy and so on. And I kind of was thinking about profit sharing, because profit sharing has, it's usually thought of from, you know, sort of a personnel perspective as being an incentive plan. If the company does well, you do well, and you identify with it, and all of that. There are lots of issues about it just in that context. But you can also think of it as a sort of a flexible pay thing in the sense that the net cost of compensation falls when the company doesn't do well. So it's kind of like cutting wages in a certain sense, even though you haven't cut the, you know, the what people think of as the wage. You've sort of cut the bonus payment. There was a fellow then, and so I was thinking of it that way and wrote some stuff about that. And there was a fellow who was one of my classmates at MIT, Marty Weitzman, who was at Harvard. Now he had started out as a Soviet expert, and which was a field, you know, back in the day when there was a Soviet, and it, you know, there was all this concern about, you know, all the competition and so on. And he spent time in Russia and learned Russian and, you know, wrote in that area. But you can also think about the Soviet system as a kind of having a complicated set of compensation arrangements, you know, even though it was a very different system. And so he then apparently began thinking about compensation systems more generally, and then, you know, whether profit sharing might have some role in maybe helping the sort of macroeconomic adjustments and so on. And he wrote, he had a much more theoretical sort of view of it, and wrote a book, he wrote both sort of professional journal type papers on this as to how the macroeconomy would benefit, if more compensation was paid in this sort of contingent profit-sharing manner, and also wrote a sort of a popular book to sort of promote this idea. So then I wrote some stuff on that, you know, sort of picking up on that. And then, you know, Gigan kind of left it for a while. Then the issue began to arise as, you know, there are a lot of concerns more generally about the functioning of the labor market. We had a downturn in the early 90s and another one, and sort of economists began returning to some extent to some of the idea, you know, are wages flexible, and how do businesses actually respond to downturns? So there was that sort of idea began, you know, sort of percolating again just because of economic conditions. And then there was also another set of papers that came out on the minimum wage, based in part on a study that had been done by some economists, looking at a whole series of sort of empirical events in the minimum wage world, where, you know, let's say on one side of a state line the minimum wage went up and another side it didn't, and you could do cross comparison. And contrary to economic theory, they kept coming up with there didn't seem to be much effect, maybe a zero effect, which, you know, created lots and lots of papers, you know, both replicating and refuting, and, you know, big
to this day,
you know, and that continues. Yeah. But one of these, they made a suggestion that one of the reasons that it might not have an effect was something that had appeared as a kind of a, for years and years, as a kind of a, oh, it's almost an undergraduate teaching tool, namely monopsony. You know, people know the word monopoly. Monopsony is the reverse, where the instead of the seller sort of being able to control the price, it's the buyer. And in the labor market, the buyer is the employer. Okay. And if you thought of the labor market as monopsonistic, we don't have to go into this for this, but if you thought of it that way, or having that element in it, and if that characterized the low wage, minimum wage world, then a bump up in the minimum wage is sort of like a monopolist offsetting a monopsonist, and might then produce this result of you don't get an adverse effect. You just sort of transfer. It's just become sort of a transfer from one side to the other, from the employer side to the employee side, with no real negative employment repercussions. So I began thinking about that more generally. Is there anything that you might suggest that the labor market more generally, not just at the minimum wage level, would have a monopsonistic element? And I came up with reasons why it might. And if it does, then that it turned out that that might have some macroeconomic implications, that the macroeconomy in a world in which that occurred might actually cushion, just the way profit sharing in the Weitzman story sort of cushioned the effect of a downturn, that you might get that same sort of effect. It was sort of profit sharing without having to share the profit, you know, in a way. The nasty side of maybe that's the way the world has been evolving. You don't get the share, but you get this sort of positive byproduct. Now, it works within a range, so that if you if you have the Great Recession that we had, then you clearly fall outside the range and all the nasty things happen. But it suggested that you could, within sort of smaller fluctuations, have less of a negative employment effect of a downturn. It would sort of cushion the effect and sort of save jobs and so on. So I wrote some papers with Chris Erickson, who is my colleague over at the Anderson School, that got some got some interest in it. And there was generally this whole field of monopsony sort of picked up because of part of these minimum wage things and part of other, you know, kind of this literature developed around this field, which, as I say, up to that point was largely the sort of undergraduate teaching thing. And here, look, we could come up with this exception to the idea that if you raised a wage demand, the number employed would fall. That the sort of standard demand curve idea would, and it was sort of a teaching tool. That, gee, if you really mastered these ideas, you could come up with this anomaly. And then there was maybe some thought about, well, maybe in some company town where the only employer was the coal mine, and one-off sort of odd little thing that you could then show, look, and here's kind of could be a real-world example. Not that anybody necessarily went to coal mining towns and gathered a lot of data about this, but that was the thought.
So coming back to wages once again.
Right. So yeah. So that was kind of my last hurrah in the in the wage world.
that's interesting. So when you retired, why didn't you retire? We can maybe come back to some other things here, but this is another question.
Well,
for the recording, Dan gave a presentation to a group of faculty thinking about retirement a few weeks ago, and he began to talk about his retirement. And at one point, the vice chancellor in the room sort of interrupted and sort of said, "Well, Dan, but this doesn't sound like retirement." It was a very useful presentation because the whole point of that session was to show people how active. But I think even those of us who invited you to that session because we wanted you to be a model for activity were a little bit shocked at how many activities you maintain, voluntary, semi-voluntary.
Right. But you had two people on the panel who were talking about them, but they were busy, even though they were retired.
Everybody was busy, but certainly you were at least as busy as the two of them.
But I think the point was you didn't have to do anything that you didn't want to do, that you didn't find of interest to do, and in a way. There was a sort of a selection bias in who you put on the panel because the panel was aimed at people who maybe were afraid of retiring because they thought there was nothing to do except sit on a rocking chair on their porch or something, and was trying to assure that group that they could continue on doing things, and
right. But you continue to teach. You continue to do research.
Right.
You
but I don't teach. I don't teach a full load.
That's true.
Right. The research I do now, I'm not sure. My sort of annual budget chapter and occasional writings that I've done since then, It appears in the public forum, but it's not. I'm not writing for peer-reviewed journals. So some, a lot of retirees continue in that vein and do those sorts of things.
You're providing a great public service. I know one of your blogs best, but I have a general sense that you actually do two blogs.
I decided. this is something you can do in retirement, because I was doing it on a weekly basis, and I decided during my teaching quarter, the world could do without me for 3 months without, without the planet would still revolve and the sun would rise in the morning and so on, even if I suspended it until April. So I did that. So that's, you know, that's something one can do.
Right. And you also, this is also very admirable, you also became a pillar of the Emeriti Association, a group that is not an easy group to be a leader of, it strikes me. You and others have been willing to put yourselves into the sometimes kind of thankless task of promoting an organization that is definitely worthwhile, but it's difficult to get a lot of our colleagues to understand why it is worthwhile. And it's been very nice to see your involvement, you know, in that. You had some very good personal reasons to sort of, you know, step down from that obligation, but you did it. You did it. Is it just you like to keep busy, or what are your motivations here? I don't want to get too much into an analysis here.
Well, usually, if somebody asks me to do something, I tend to do it unless, you know, it becomes too burdensome. So, I mean, this was just the way I sort of stumbled into that presidency of the North American Economics and Finance, so because somebody else was on the board and they were having some problems in getting people to do things and so on. And gradually, you know, so something happened and then something else happened. Path dependency is the phrase we like to use. You know, so Steve Cederbaum, who had been involved with me on, for example, on the board of the Faculty Association, you know, so he became involved in the Emeriti Association and still is very much involved there. But he sort of pulled me into it. So that's how that happened. And it's, you know, just things happen.
Yeah. Do you, other than your teaching, the teaching of the course with Dukakis, do you have much to do with the two, well, with both of your schools, both Anderson and
well, not with Anderson. I occasionally go to a seminar or something there, but the group that I was in has, you know, kind of moved in very different directions from my general interests, and I'm not teaching there anymore, so, you know, I still get the emails and so on, but and they're nice enough to, I have a, you know, I share a clerical employee who prints out a lot of stuff for me that's helpful. But beyond that, not too much contact there. So most of my stuff has been over here in public affairs.
Right. And it's worth noting for the tape that you chose. You could have had, you know, probably substantially fancier digs over in the School of Management, but you chose to be here in the much more proletarian digs of the School of Public Policy. In an office that is, again, a modest office.
Right. Well, if I had stayed at Anderson, eventually they would have moved me on to the bullpen over there. So I wouldn't have retained it indefinitely. I sort of retained it for a while for reasons that we discussed, I think, on the last go round, but since I'm over here with actual responsibilities, I, you know,
Yeah. And the teaching with Dukakis, which has now gone on for about 2 decades, is, I mean, the two of you will last forever probably, but just in case you should, you know, I don't know, trip on your shoelace or something like that. Are there any, are there young people who are in the on the wings to take over that class, or is that a class that
well, not that I know of. I mean, it, you know, the formula for doing it is such that lots of people could do it, mm-hmm. Because you know, you, but you would need at least over time to have enough interest in it to sort of put in the effort. Because as I say, we read all the papers, we don't right. delegate that yeah. to TA, you know, and so on. Somebody with a very busy research agenda and so on might not be
a hardworking associate professor want
to do that. And you do need to sort of keep up with things that are going on in California that you know that would require some time outside the actual teaching period. So even though we rely heavily on guest speakers, you kind of need to know, you know, kind of where to look for them and
who to invite
and you know, kind of what different people do and so on. So but again, it's certainly doable. Obviously, over time things have changed, and now our, you know, our median undergraduate was just about born at the time that Dukakis and I started together, let alone 1988 when he ran for president. I mean, that's back, you know,
so you have
mixed
to,
up
you
with,
have to
you
explain
know,
to them who he is.
Napoleon and, you know, dinosaurs and, you know, all that, you know, back in the day kind of world.
But for now, you do plan to continue that course.
Right,
so
right. We do. Basis. Right, yeah, we do. And it's good that as you say, trip over shoelaces, because there was a point a couple years ago where suddenly I ended up in the emergency room,
yes.
and he was there to complete the course. So having two people do it is very helpful.
Well, Dan, this has been 3 delightful afternoons. I'm sure there's a lot that we have missed, and maybe some things will be edited down, but we have a lot of rich material about your career, about UCLA over a really long, you know, spread of its history, really from a good university to, you know, it was never bad, but to, you know, to one that really just, you know, moved up there. And part of the policy, the development of the policy program, it's a good exemplar of the kind of ways in which a university like UCLA does thrive. And it thrives because it has people like you who are willing to do
it. Thank you.
So anything you'd like to, is there anything that we left out that's on your mind that you want to talk about?
Well, I just, I'll add one thing, because you mentioned this blog that I do for the faculty association, which often has, let's say, critical elements of various policies and events that occur at the university.
Oh, I hadn't noticed.
you might have noticed that. I think the thing to state, you also said that, you know, I've been involved, but I'm not one of the people who wave signs and do that sort of thing. I think what is often hard for people to understand in lots of contexts is that all human organizations have some level of defect in them, at least as any one person would perceive it. That doesn't mean that they are sort of bad organizations, or even that there is some magic wand that you could wave that would, you know, just do this and all those defects would disappear and you'd have this absolutely perfect university or whatever it is that you're talking about. It's very hard for certain people, including people I know very well, to kind of conceive of nuances and that organizations are complicated and that there is this notion of path dependency, that things happen and you just can't write off everything that has gone on, whether it's embedded in a law or just a tradition or a practice or whatever. I think academia is particularly rife with people who can't conceive of that there is a gap between perfection and the way the world is going to be for an indefinite period, and that maybe there are incremental things that can be done that could possibly improve the situation, but don't necessarily avoid all evils and all imperfections.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you just spend your time protecting that organization.
Right. You try to sort of move it along iteratively, and there are points sometimes in the life of organizations where they do have to move a little more quickly than they go to the left. But sometimes they nonetheless can be quite valuable to society as a whole.
Well, that's how you help the institution thrive, by helping it be better. Keep it up, Dan.